Hi, everybody. I'm Petey Confredos, and when I hear this music every single week, it's pretty difficult to feel down or depressed. This is upbeating music that will hopefully help us to feel good and really into our days. Well, I'm Petey Confredos, and I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. And of course, I'm the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I am also the advice columnist for Dan's newspapers in the Hamptons. You can read two Ask Petey columns every single month. And I'm a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest. And I can hardly believe that I have been hosting the Ask Petey show right here on the Progressive Radio Network since 2013. It is amazing. It's absolutely amazing how quickly the time has gone. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the very first time, I want you to know that this show is really about empowerment. It is about all of the things that we can actually do, not just talk about, not just daydream about and wish and hope, but actually do to improve the quality of our lives and the quality of our relationships. So what are the topics? What are the issues that we talk about here on the Ask Petey show? Well, of course, we talk about mental health, and we talk about sexuality and relationships and all of the things that we can actually do to maximize our physical and emotional and psychological well-being, really, despite the stressors of life. And we've certainly experienced a lot of stressors in the last few years. And my mantra, and of course, it's not always easy to do, but the mantra that I think really helps us to move forward in our lives is basically to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can, even though we can't change our history, the things that continue to get in the way of our lives and of our relationships. You know, every week I talk about the depression statistics in the United States. Half of all Americans are apparently seeking help for depression. 17 million adults, and I know that number has really gone up in the last few years with the pandemic, suffer from clinical depression. 40 million Americans are suffering from a variety of anxiety disorders. And of course, if we're looking at relationships, and I keep hoping that despite all the self-help books and therapists and coaches and shows dealing with relationships, that we're going to see our relationships across the board doing a lot better. But in fact, that does not seem to be the case at all, because three women are killed every single day by their so-called intimate partner. If we are looking at the divorce rate, 48% of first marriages end in divorce. 67% of second marriages, they end in divorce as well. And if we're looking at third marriages, one would hope, okay, we've gone through divorce number one, we've gone through divorce number two, but hopefully there may be a happily ever after if you're marrying for the third or fourth time. And yet, couples marrying for the third time, 74% of third marriages also end in divorce. But you know, there are things that we can actually do to change that statistics and to be able to hopefully find our happily ever after in our romantic and in our love relationships. And I've identified over the years, and for people who've been listening to the show, you've heard me say this many, many times, but I feel that it is really worthwhile to repeat that if we are ever going to expect and hope to have a healthy relationship, there are really three things that we need to do. And the first thing is that we need to get ourselves into a really good place. And that means that each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally and mentally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And what that means, we have to dig deep and we have to deal with our demons and our old issues, what I call skeletons in the closet, and our unfinished business. And I said this many, many times over the years, is that, and I really do believe this, that our relationships really do need to be the icing on the cake. And that we need to be the cake. We need to be in a good place. We need to be strong so that our relationships will then be able to complement a basically healthy and happy individual. And I know that it's easy to hope and wish that somebody might save us. You know, the damsel, the fairy tales that we all grew up with, how the prince is going to save the damsel in distress. Well, unfortunately, in the real world, the damsel in distress and the man who is also not only in distress, but maybe also very depressed, we have a responsibility to try and save ourselves. And that really means, dealing with our issues. And of course, number two, we need to become students of a relationship education. And that means really having clarity about the ingredients that go into healthy relationships. And number three is my formula. And again, for those of you who've been listening to the Ask Beattie Show for all these years, you know that I did research with 450 people in the Boston and Connecticut areas, and I came up with a formula. And I am a very, very bottom line person. If it doesn't work, let's not waste our time talking about it. But what the formula is, it's an assessment formula. It's an assessment evaluation that helps us really and truly evaluate who our partner is and who our partner is not. And the interesting thing about the formula, and I was very upset when I realized that this was not something that could be done in a week or in a month or in 2 months, and that my research found that it takes close to a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody actually is not, and that you absolutely cannot fast forward the process. So again, we need to be okay. We need to be very, very clear about the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship. And then we have to be willing. We really have to be willing to play out this assessment. Because when you think about it, we assess every single thing in our lives. If we're going to buy a phone or a computer or a car or a house, we are on the computer and we are looking. We're looking at reviews and we're reading consumer reports. And yet it's the same kind of process. It's the same kind of thing that we need to do when we are evaluating the people that we think that we want in our life. And, you know, I know that before I did my research, I would meet somebody and I would make a comment. I'd say, well, what a lovely person. What a lovely woman. Or what an honest man. And what I've learned over the years is that I would never, ever, ever, ever make that kind of a statement today. And that the best, the very, very best that I could say is that I have met someone who appears, and that is really the key word, who appears to be wonderful and honest and lovely and trustworthy. And then I'm going to know who this person really is in about a year. And it is a great great, great way, my friends, to educate ourselves and empower ourselves, and above all, to keep ourselves safe. So last week, you know, with the beginning of the new year, I asked you to do your own inventory. And the question was, you know, really, how am I doing? How are you doing when it comes to mental health? And are you dealing? Are you absolutely committed in the new year to successfully dealing and tackling your depression or your anxiety or your substance abuse of various different kinds? And it's very easy to just say, well, someday I may tackle these issues that continue to get in the way of my life and my relationships. And it's just amazing how time really does go by, so that if depression or anxiety or other psychological issues are really hampering your being able to live a happy and joyful life, I hope that I can convince you once and for all that you do not need to navigate all of this on your own, and that the very, very best thing that you can do is actually reach out and ask for help. And by the way, you know, I want to give you the number here on the Ask Beattie Show. The call-in number is 888-874-4888. And feel free to comment or to call. And if you have any particular question that you would like to ask me, the show, of course, is live, as you know, from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every single Monday. So again, that number right now, if you have a question or a comment, the number is 888-874-4888. And also, you know, we were talking about the importance of continuing to evaluate our relationships and to making sure that the people in your life are people who really care about you and who are able to add something significant and positive to your life. And, you know, when Gary Noel talks about toxins, he usually talks about chemical toxins. And when Beattie Covarrubias talks about toxins, I usually am referring to toxic situations and toxic people. And of course, whether we're talking about chemical toxins or whether we're talking about toxic people, the importance is to eliminate all toxins from our life as best as we possibly can. And again, looking at our physical health, and I know it's hard, especially when it's cold outside. There are difficult times to try and really stay in shape. And yet there are things that we need to do. I mean, I count on my free weights in the apartment, whether or not I feel like I have the time or whether or not I am motivated. There's certain things that need to be done, that we need to do every single day, that can make a positive difference in our life. And if we're talking about sleep again, you know, just think about your sleeping patterns and making sure at least that you're getting 7 or 8 hours of restful sleep most nights. And again, the concept of self-care, we see it, we read about it. And again, it's important for you to ask yourself, you know, are you taking good care of yourself physically and mentally and spiritually? And do you feel that you are living a life of purpose and spiritual satisfaction? Do you know how to relax and enjoy the beauty of life and nature around you? And do you try and surround yourself with loving and supportive people who can actually help you appreciate the joy and mystery of life? And all of this comes under the umbrella of self-care. And when it comes to goals, you know, with a new year, we all make New Year's resolutions. And I think that study showed that within a couple of weeks, makes most New Year's resolutions, they just kind of go by the wayside. But do you feel that you are actually clear about your goals for the new year? And are they achievable and realistic and satisfying? And even though you've yet, of course, the new year's just begun, to fully achieve them, do you feel that you are on the right path to eventually reach them? And again, there's so much to navigate in our lives. And it's been, I think, really made so much more difficult by the pandemic. And we're still not sure, should we be wearing masks or not wearing masks? And some people are wanting to not vaccinate. And of course, it's really important, I feel, to listen to the experts in the world who are trying to guide us and who are trying to help us to really stay healthy and you know, stay safe. So I think that it is, I think it's really important to ask ourselves the tough questions. And if you're finding that things are really off track in your life, I think it's important to acknowledge it. And then you're going to have to make some decisions about what you are actually planning to do to go from A to B to C to D. And with the complexities of life that we are all dealing with, you know, there are coaches and therapists, and there are people who can really, really add something very, very positive to the path and the paths that we are wanting to be on. So again, you know, it's not a weakness. And I think that more and more, certainly in the last couple of years, people are talking about going to therapy. And I think that the stigma is much, much, much less than it ever was. I mean, years ago, you know, when you heard that somebody was going to see a psychiatrist or they were going to see a therapist, you think, my, oh my, what is wrong with them? Are they crazy? Or are they sick? And I think that we've learned, hopefully, a lot in the last number of years, is that having that extra support, we all need that extra support. I mean, you look at athletes who have coaches and trainers and teams. And we all, too, need coaches and people who are on our team, who we can contact, who we can call, who we can reach out to, who can really help us navigate our lives in ways that will make our life a lot easier. So again, if you are struggling in any particular way, it's a new year and you may have thought about getting some help in the past, but today is the day. And again, if you have any questions or comments for me right now on the Ask BD Show, you can call me live. The number is 888-874-4888. Well, today, of course, is Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And as I was preparing for this part of the show, I was just thinking how what we need in this world, whether we're talking about Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday or whether we're talking about poverty or income inequality or racism, what we all do need right now is we need to love each other. We need to be much more connected with each other. So let's start this segment with one of my favorite songs, and that is What the World Needs Now is Love. And the song is by Jackie DeShannon. So enjoy and join in with Jackie DeShannon. It's a beautiful song, and I hope that we are all really going to take this in. You know, I was looking at some of the details about Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. He was born in 1929. And just think, it was on January the 15th. Just think, he would have been 93 years old today. I wonder what he would be thinking about what's happened in all of these years. And of course, as you know, he was assassinated April the 4th, 1968. Well, I have a guest today, and we are going to be talking about really how far have African Americans come since the 1960s. And my guest, of course, is my husband, Jim Bredos, who is a sociologist and an activist, and who is the host of a really wonderful show, The Radical Imagination, on MNN. So, Jim, you've been involved in this for your entire life.
Yes, yeah. And again, thank you so much for having me on. It's always a pleasure. I just did a show recently with a couple of friends from Denver High School. And I hadn't realized this, but one of my friends there's mother was the movement leader for the desegregation of the Denver public schools. Now, again, this is back in the late 60s. So, yeah, this has been a long journey that I've been on, that America's been on, that the country, the culture has been dealing with, trying to deal with. And I appreciated the song you sang.
I tried to
sing.
Yes,
you sing it too very well. And certainly we do need that love. But we need also policies and programs that go into the structural, institutional violence and racism that's still being perpetuated. And it's perhaps even more nuanced and more complex. But anyway, we'll have a chance to talk more about this. So thanks for having me.
Well, you know, one question. I mean, we've been together a long time. We've been married now for almost 6 years. We've known each other really almost a lifetime. I don't think I've ever asked you this question, Jim. Why did you get involved in this struggle when you were a kid?
Oh, gosh.
How did it all happen for you?
It was no real conscious decision. I don't think it was just part of my upbringing. It was just it was just so natural that I would be involved, for example, in the first Vietnam summer protesting the war in Vietnam, or in voter registration in Denver. I guess it's family background again. I guess it's the exploitation, the hurts, the traumas that my own people went through, and the lessons that they learned, and they didn't give up. They didn't become negative about it, but it taught me that bullies of all sorts need to be stood up to and responded to. So again, this was just something that came very naturally. It wasn't any revelation or any sudden abrupt change in my life.
And yet for me, having grown up in Canada, it was a revelation, and it was something. This was in the 60s. This was something that nobody talked about. And I was very, very fortunate to have a father who was a writer, who wrote for newspapers, who cared about the issues. We had all these books on segregation and racism in the house. And had it not been for him, I would have had absolutely no idea what was really going on in America. And I have to say, I probably wouldn't have cared had I not had the kind of a father who cared about everybody, who cared about poor, who cared about rich, who cared about people. And so for me, it was just, I think it was something that was very fortunate that I had those early lessons of awareness.
Well, I think what you're pointing out, and an important lesson for the audience, whoever is out there, whatever background, is that we all have our narrative. We all have traumas and hurts from our relatives, from our ancestors, what they went through in different parts of the world and so on. So each of us, whoever we may be, has this in our background, and we need to be aware of it, be aware of what it's done to us, and act in a way so it can be more positively dealt with in our own circumstance, our own lives, and with who we come in contact with. So it goes beyond the black-white issue, although in America, along with, of course, a Native American genocide there, that's our major racial dilemma. And one thing I would like to just get in here before we go further is when we talk about the situation, I think I would start with what is going on in white America, not necessarily what's going on in black America, because white America is the America that has set the standard, if you will, or set the norm and has the power and to continue, perpetuate, or radically change the history that we've had to experience.
Well, you have to be aware, and I think even more importantly, you really have to care. And you gave me this article yesterday on the title of the article, George Floyd, How Far Have African Americans Come Since the 1960s? So, for example, if we're looking at family wealth, in 2019, the latest data available, the average wealth of a white family was almost seven times more than a black family in the United States, and that the black-white wealth gap was larger in 2019. And I thought this was really depressing and interesting statistic. So it was larger in 2019 than it was in 1983, Jim, when black family wealth data was first collected.
Well, let's
how can this be? Give the audience some perspective.
Okay. You can't not deal with the issue of slavery. And that's where this incredible disparity in wealth really begins. When you have people that you are exploiting and working for nothing, having them work for nothing for you and accumulating all this wealth, there's going to be this enormous disparity. So when you include in that Jim Crow policies and structural racism and ghettoization of people, it's not surprising that you have such disparity. Now, certainly there has been some progress. I'm not saying there isn't, but there's enormous differential in wealth, continues to be. And until we have addressed issues like reparations or other policies, so-called policies that can make the disparity much less, we're going to continue to have the same sort of rates.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about reparations, and of course, we have a house in East Hampton, and I know that you have been involved in talking with a number of the leaders, the leadership in East Hampton, about this very issue, which is reparation. And I think a lot of people may be very surprised to learn that there were a lot of whites living in the Hamptons who actually were slave owners. I mean, this was something I knew, of course, about.
Well, I didn't either. Actually, David Rattray and Don Marie Barnes are the co-founders of the Plain Sight Project, which is a remarkable research study on slavery in the Hamptons and Long Island and in the North generally, in New England as well. Absolutely. There were every white family of some means in East Hampton had slaves. Including David's family.
I mean, this is never talked about.
Well, no, of course, that's exactly right. So these statistics are important to go into, but looking beyond the statistics And what they all mean at a human level is also what we need to get down to. But you mentioned, yeah, this is something that East Hampton and other towns and cities and communities across the country, south, north, west, and so on, are all going to have to grapple with. And
but do they want to grapple with it?
It may not be that they've been so used to being in positions of privilege and power they may not want to give up much of it. But you know, the people are people of goodwill, whatever background. You try to reach out to them in the spirit of love and fairness and within the American tradition of fairness. White ethnics did have a lot of benefits given to them through the Homestead Act by the federal government, which gave millions and millions of acres to largely white ethnic families in the Midwest and the West. So, yes, we need to talk about this, and we need to realize that this is the fair way to go about things. This is the loving way to begin to heal the wounds. And I think in some ways, symbolically, we can start. I know what the rabbi out, your friend Josh.
And Rabbi Franklin.
Rabbi Franklin and Minister Walter Thompson of the Calvary Church, they've come up with a largely symbolic but still important plan where they will be laying bricks to commemorate places where slave owners did hold slaves. So we've got to go beyond that. We've got to go beyond that and come up with policies that make it fairer, more decent opportunities for housing, job opportunities, education, health, and so on, that can bridge the gap between these horrendous differentials in statistics that you're talking about
here. Do you think that people who are not African Americans and who've not had a history, a very, very painful history in this country, do you think that they care?
That is such a great, great question that we're all grappling with. You know who does it very well and talks about it is Reverend William Barber when he talks about fusion politics. Well, I think you've got to get clear to people, as King tried to do, if you're going to get down in the mud and hold your neck, hold your foot on somebody's black person's neck in the mud, that you're going to get filthy yourself. This is bringing you down to a level that you shouldn't be interacting with. So I think this idea of fusion politics, as Barber brilliantly points out, when black, particularly in the South, but elsewhere, our upper Midwest, are hurt by policies, it's not just blacks. It's mainly whites who are not getting the sort of programs that would increase their level of quality of life and so much. And that's what I think we need to do. We're not all going to kumbaya and love each other instantaneously, but it's in all our interests to care more deeply about each other and have policies that benefit all of us, rather than have a system which divides and conquers us and puts people down as poor blacks are, and have poor whites, southern whites in particular, be somewhat above them, so at least they can feel a little more superior. That's sick stuff. That's material for the therapist to deal with.
I think that, you know, if it was not Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday today, people would probably not be thinking about this or talking about this, certainly not the majority of people. And yet
Why
I was
would you
looking
say that, though?
Because
think
I think
of what, first of all, think of
thinking about racism, thinking about income inequality.
But you don't think people are hurting?
Yes.
You don't think people all over this country, the great, great majority, are worried about where they're getting the next paycheck, how they're going to pay the bills, the medical bills, and so on. So they're all hurting. Most of the country is hurting.
But what my point is, yes, is do you think that people would be talking about and thinking about Black poverty. They may be thinking about their own poverty.
Well, I think the narrative has to be dealt with in a much more intelligent, mature way. I think what you're talking about in the past has been the sort of dog whistle of narrative where we don't really deal with the issues, but we sort of nod and think, oh yeah, we're talking about Black people here who are the real criminals in these crime stories and so on, while not blatantly admitting that. And that's also destructive. I think we need to get honest with each other and bring these things out in the open and deal with each other's differences and feelings in a much more open way, which I think we're beginning to do, and it's painful and difficult. I know we watched, not to move from this, but Marilyn Monroe, we watched that CNN program last night. It was an interesting program, how you reframing Marilyn Monroe. And it was a very interesting way that hadn't been really expressed very much, more from a woman's point of view.
I think there are certainly a lot of things that need to be framed. And yet,
we need to deal with race too.
And yet, in looking at these statistics, and I think that many people would say, well, things are a lot better. Now, for example, in 2019, the Black poverty rate was 18.8%, about half of what it was in 1966. So I think a lot of people would say, well, see, things are really...
statistics are very... Right. You really got to go beneath the surface there. What sort of jobs are we talking about? Who is still doing
right.
The brunt of the dirty work in the sense in the society? What is the discrepancy? What we need to really focus on is change the narrative to the fact that six people in this country own more than half of the wealth. Okay, yeah. 600 people own more than 80% of the wealth. 90% of the stocks in this country are owned by less than 10% of the population. So you've got to go beyond these statistics and dig a lot deeper into what they're actually saying.
No, you're absolutely
and
right.
And I'm not saying that things haven't gotten somewhat better.
I'm just looking at some of these statistics here. For example, more African Americans had completed 4 years of higher education by 2019 than ever before.
But where are the jobs? What are the good jobs? Where are the union jobs where people can actually have a decent salary and can afford to get decent housing and so on and develop the community contacts and community foundation that they need to build healthier lives? That's not what you see what I'm saying? That data is not telling you that.
No, obviously that's true. And I was looking also at the incarceration rates. Now these rates, Jim, for me are shocking. Okay. For example, white men 18 or older, 1 in 106 white men 18 or older are incarcerated. All right. For Black men 18 or older, I mean, this is a very, very upsetting statistic. It's 1 in 15. So you have 1 in 106 white men. And 1 in 15 Black men 18 or older.
Well, and also then if you add the economic variable, that's always been true that the poor, whether they were white ethnics or Blacks, were always the ones that were incarcerated. That raises the whole question of what the hell do we have prison for? What is that function? What is that purpose? And gets us into issues like the drug war and the racial disparity there. We all know that whites abuse drugs, so-called illegal drugs, much more than Blacks, and yet Blacks disproportionately are incarcerated. So obviously, the narrative that's been built up to mistrust, to fear Black men in particular, and this is the mechanism of social control that politicians and judges and mayors and prosecutors and so on have to perpetuate that sickness, that, and thank goodness for people like a Barber and Black Lives Matter, who are now trying to get us to see the complexity of this.
Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the incarceration statistics for women. And this is interesting that for white women ages 35 to 39, the incarceration rate is one in 355. And for Black women aged 35 to 39, the statistic is one in 100. And this is an interesting age range as well. You figure between 35 to 39.
What's going on there?
What is going on in these women's lives? Lots of depression, I'm sure, relationship issues, economic. Economic worries, kids. Yes.
And why in God's name is prison being used as a vehicle to deal with these sorts of issues? These are issues of poverty, of emotional health, of job training, of education, mm-hmm. of nurturing and health care and so on. We incarcerate more. The invention of prison is an American invention. Let's be very clear about that. We use it more than any other country in the world. We incarcerate more people than any other country in the world. And that's got to stop. We've got to, not just putting Black people away, white people, all kinds of people away. This is not the place for them.
And what's interesting too, and again, very, very depressing and upsetting, is that Black Americans are incarcerated at a rate five times more than white Americans.
Well, it's again, you know, it's a narrative that gets perpetuated and in people's minds. Yeah, these are dangerous
people.
And they obviously need to be there. And that's, you know, a good part of the country believes that. And, you know, we're on the Upper West Side here and all this and New York. But we have our own. Hey, we have a police chief who is calling for more of imprisonment.
And a woman,
Black
yes.
woman.
Yes.
And a Black police chief who is calling for bringing back some of the failed policies of the past few years. And we have an African-American DA who is opposing that. So a lot of the interesting things happening. So it cuts across race and goes beyond the issues of Black and white. And to keep in mind, again, to go back to King's movement was initially a Southern movement for civil rights, but he ended up leading a movement of human rights around the world. I think that has to be emphasized. This wasn't just a specific movement for a specific group of people. This has grown and expanded into a universal movement for human rights around the world and can and should be applied everywhere.
You know, when I think back, Jim, I was one of the three directors of the Montreal School Social Services Program. So there were hundreds of schools. And our mission, our goal was to make sure that there was going to be no child left behind when it came to education, when it came to mental health issues, you know, beginning in the kindergarten level. And, you know, I think back about how we all worked as a team. So let's say little Johnny or little Annie was acting out. Rather than give little Johnny and Annie detention, the teacher understood, especially if it was a recurring problem, to refer these young little kids to a school social worker. So we would assess the situation. We would speak with the teacher to make sure that there were no learning problems. If we suspected learning problems, there would be a referral to a school psychologist. I remember, because I started out as an inner city school social worker, I would go to the people's houses and I would sit there with the families and try to figure out what is it that is going on with the little kid, why the person is acting out, why this little boy or little girl is underachieving. And we worked together as a team to try to make sure that the kids were going to be okay emotionally, psychologically, physically, and academically. And so for me, this is the way I lived. This is the way I was trained. And we were able, I am absolutely sure, to prevent little Johnny and little Annie from ending up in prison.
But you're missing one very big difference between the American and Canadian experience. This was all in public schools, correct?
Yes.
The great majority of people, Canadian kids, go to public school, excellent public school.
Right.
Okay. What we have is a segregated school system. The public schools in big cities are basically left for, overwhelmingly, they're for kids of color. And what you have is a private school system where richer and privileged, mainly white kids are put. And the money is the incredible amounts of money that are going there preparing these kids for, prestigious boarding schools and universities and so on. So it starts very, very early. I think that what we need to do is, when I went to New York City public schools, it was the best in the country, perhaps best in the world. Maybe right after or near Canada's. But it was an excellent, excellent education. And that's what I think we need to get back to, is put these resources full speed, as you were saying, in these excellent program that you were part of. So it benefits kids in that public schools. But I think what you've got to do is stop the segregation within the public school system. I'm sorry, within our educational system. The disparities have lessened to a certain extent. Some of the Ivy Leagues have made inroads and tried to get some of the brightest kids from the inner city ghetto communities. But it's a trickle. It's a trickle. The great masses have not been affected. And so that's where America has to really start taking note of itself and get serious. And as you were saying in your opening there about how serious is it really going to be to face the dilemma that we have, and how serious and honestly are we going to attack? And somebody is going to, there's going to have to be some give and take on this too. There's going to have to be a readjustment of privilege, of resources, and so on. And these are hard, difficult questions.
See, I'm very curious, and I don't have the answer, and you probably don't have the answer right now either, but I'm wondering, let's take New York. In the inner city areas of New York, what kind of resources, school social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, guidance counselors are available to the kids in these schools as compared to, let's not even look at the private schools, as compared to the public schools on the Upper West Side or on the Upper East Side?
Well, there's some selected, very good public schools on both the East and West.
But I'm wondering about the resources. I'm wondering whether or not, and this would be something, maybe somebody knows, maybe somebody can email me or call me, whether or not the inner city schools in our area have sufficient is the word, psychologists, resource people, school social workers, guidance counselors that then would be able to identify early on kids that were having issues, kids that were living in situations that were either dangerous emotionally or physically or sexually or economically.
Look,
because that's where it begins.
I think there are, I'm sure we can do better on the resources, but again, you're dealing with what we call structural violence and structural issues that go so deep into the culture and the housing and the job training and the parenting that, you know, at this point, certainly added resources at the public school level can make a difference to a certain extent, but we're talking about monumental healing of a people, of a culture, that's going to have to go beyond just having some more social workers or, you know, psychiatrists or whatever in the system. I'm not saying that we shouldn't. So this is asking for more radical progressive structural change that is going to, you know, it's not going to be easy to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you believe that the idea of, and not just the idea, but the implementation of reparations is going to have some significant impact emotionally and also economically, well, if this actually happens?
Yeah, well, that's a good way of putting it. So we haven't even come to the point where we as a country, as a culture, have apologized for slavery. So we are not even at that level. And you know, as a therapist, know how important that is to have accomplished in a therapeutic process. So, yeah, I mean, look, the reparations can take a variety of forms. They can take, again, more. I think Bernie Sanders talks about it to a certain extent when he talks about free college education. That would be for all, community college and junior colleges and so on, and public colleges and so on. I think that's what we also need to realize. That's what partly reparations could be, and bringing people, giving them the quality of education that some of us, that I was fortunate enough to have in the New York City public school system. So I think that's what's going to have to be done. Those sorts of broad programs, it's going to take money and resources, and we have it. It's going, again, as I mentioned, we spend trillions of dollars in the military. We have six people, I think it was three or six people worth $950 billion in the country. I mean, it's outrageous. Who? That's not America. That's not the way it should be. It's just unfair. It's unjust. And they have the power to set the policies and programs, not just these people, but a substantial number of the very, very wealthy and powerful. They don't care what's going on in the inner city public schools. They're never there. They're taking their private jets and their yachts all over the world and so on and so on, making enormous amounts of money in the stock market. So these are very, very hard issues. And I think you said Martin Luther King would be 93 today. He would just say,
what would he say,
Jim? Well, he'd say, America, okay, he did say, unless you get with it, America, you're going to go to hell. But he also said, we can be redeemed, and we can listen to our better angels, and we can do the right thing. And Reverend Barber is saying that goes beyond liberal and conservative and Democrat, Republican. It's right and wrong. It's a decent thing to do.
Well, you know, it's the decent thing to do.
And the loving thing to do.
Yes, but people need to care about all of this. And so many people, especially in the last few years, I mean, are struggling, you know, within
their... They need to care about themselves.
They need
to say therapeutically. You talk about that all the time.
I do. And I say that unless you're in a good place yourself, it's pretty difficult, if not impossible, to be really caring about anybody else.
Absolutely.
And we've been through, and we're still in the middle of this pandemic. There's been a huge upheaval for everybody. I mean, the rage, the way people are acting out. I mean, you read about this, you see this on planes and the subways. I mean, there's such rage, and of course, underneath the rage is a lot of pain.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of pain.
They're being abused.
Yeah.
They're being abused, they're being lied to, and they know it. And blacks and others may become Muslims become the scapegoats. Ridiculous. They're not the ones that are doing it. They're not the ones that are causing the issue. And that's, I think, what Martin Luther King would be preaching today. And I love him very much. I wish he, you know, we need to listen to his voice again. He was really one of a kind and a beautiful, beautiful man. And we we need to carry on his message, and there are people doing that today.
And we need to think about all of these issues, not just once a year.
Oh, absolutely. Every day.
It's every day. And I think that people can really make a difference, you know, if we come together.
And you do that too with your own practice. And I see it every day, how you care and you make the enormous progress. That's what King would be talking about too. At a one-to-one level, we need to do these sorts of things as well.
Caring and loving and doing, and as my late father used to say, and never, never giving up. Well, listen, yes. Jim, you know, as usual, it is always great.
Yes, we got to give up the time here.
To talk with you.
Thank you.
Really, I love your insights, but much more than your insights, I love the fact that you have been really committed to all of this, not just as a professor and a sociologist, but as an activist, and that this is how you live your life on a day-to-day basis. I mean, and it's very impressive. I think we could all have a very positive and strong takeaway from the way you live your life.
And it's natural, and it makes you happy too.
No.
It's the way to be.
Absolutely. Well, again, thanks again. And everybody, you can tune in multiple times during the week and watch the Radical Imagination on MNN. Well, here we are. It's 3:57. I wanted to talk about a lot of issues, including the joys and challenges of sex after 70, the gift of validation in relationships. But I guess we are going to definitely have to wait till next week to tackle all those issues again. I want to thank all of you so much for tuning in every single week and for going to the archives and listening to the shows. I've done actually several hundred shows over all of these years. And every single week, I hope, you know, my motivation for doing the Ask Speedy show is that I hope that every single week that it may be some small little thing. It may be really insignificant, but it may be significant to you, that will help you in some way improve the quality of your life and your relationship. And I leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first is that we all need to do everything that we can possibly do to improve the quality of our own lives and relationships. And of course, that really means loving ourselves. And of course, secondly, we all need to do, and not just on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, but we need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other and care about each other. So again, have a really good rest of the day, everybody. And I will be with you next Monday and every Monday live Eastern Standard Time, 3:00. So take good care, stay warm, be well, love yourselves and love each other. Bye-bye, everybody.